Today, I come to what is probably, so far as my lecture is concerned, the most important of all my lectures, and that is the decline in theology. Those of you who have been here for 2 weeks and those of you who have been here for a week will notice that I have been centering upon the decline in American jurisprudence, the decline in American constitutional government, the decline in education. After analyzing the position in which we now find ourselves. Now, when institutions decline, whether they be political, educational, cultural, economic, so on, it is due to the fact that the motivating philosophy which brought them into being has lost its force. To this extent, I think Toynbee is very correct when he points out that the basic idea of civilization is that it arises around the vigorous leadership of a creative minority. Not a dominant minority, but a creative minority. A minority which, by virtue of its inherent strength, is able to captivate the allegiance of the people and mold them into a working force. In other words, a basic philosophy produces a culture, and that culture produces an appropriate civilization as a response to the demands of that philosophy through its cultural outlook. Now, this is a very important point, but I would add another point, for I certainly do not go along with Toynbee at all points in his program. Behind every philosophy, whether it be political, social, economic, or educational, there is a theology. All men are religious. There is no such thing as a religious vacuum. We either worship God in spirit and in truth, or we worship Him in error. Western culture, therefore, is the product of a basic biblical theology. When Augustine, in his last great works, conquered the classical philosophy and captured it in the name of Christ, he laid the foundations, he provided the sinews for medieval culture. Now, medieval culture was far from being a perfect Christian culture. I would certainly admit that. In fact, I would not only admit it, I would insist upon it. For gradually, Augustine gave way to Aristotle, and in the 13th century, there was enthroned, of course, the Thomistic theology. And you may wonder how I ever got to the Middle Ages and then to American problems, the decline of American theology. Well, I will get there. And right, speedily, I hope. And no doubt you share that optimism. To summarize all I've been saying, the decline in American life, or the cause of the present dilemma, is directly traceable to the decline of American theology. For if any nation was ever founded upon theological insights, it certainly was this country. And the American dream, as I said last week, the American dream is Puritan and Calvinistic in nature. It was born of Puritanism. It was born of Calvinism. It was born of the theology of the Huguenots, the Anglican Church, the New England Puritans, the Dutch Reformed, so on. Gradually, the tremendous momentum which it gave to our culture gave way, simply because the theological foundations were being slowly eroded. Until today, they are virtually destroyed in many segments of the Protestant Church in this country. Now, may I remind you of something? And this perhaps you might not think germane, but I believe I can prove later that it will be. In the Western world, there are only 3 main theologies. There was the Thomistic synthesis, known as Thomism, which was the dominant theology of the Middle Ages, certainly after 1250, and insidiously even before then, although it had not gained the name of Thomism. There is Lutheranism, and there is Calvinism. I say that in the Western world, there are only 3 basic theologies within Christendom. Now, some of you may ask, what about the Orthodox Church and Greek theology? To which I have 2 answers, and you may select one. By its definition, the Orthodox or the Greek Church is really semi-Eastern, Russian in nature, Greek in nature, and not really native to the Western mind. Or, if you wish, another possible answer. Although it differs at points, the theology of the Greek Church is really not too much different from that of the Western Roman Church. It differs in some particulars, but the basic stream is Aristotelian and Augustinian, with a greater prominence of Aristotle than of Augustine. So we come to the Reformation, and we have appearing two other theologies, Lutheranism and Calvinism. Now, with the apparent inclination toward a bias, perhaps, and you may so dub it if you care, may I point out to you that Calvinism, with its foundations thoroughly geared to Augustinianism, is the highest theological achievement of the sanctified Christian mind. Thus, and I will have you note this, that whenever attacks are launched against Christianity, almost always they are launched against Calvinism. Very seldom do you see Methodist theology attacked. Very seldom do you see Lutheran theology attacked. Now, in military strategy, a wise commander always picks the focal point by which, if he gains a victory, he will demolish his opponents. Thus, the enemies of Christianity have done exactly the same thing. They have always picked Calvinism to attack. Before Calvin, they picked Augustine. They didn't pick Origen. They didn't pick Clement of Alexandria. They didn't pick even Athanasius. They picked Augustine. And for a good reason. If Augustine fell, the rest of the citadel fell. And since 1560, if Calvinism falls, the rest of the citadel falls. This is very observable in church history. Now you'll say, well, what about Methodist theology? What about the 260-some groups we have in this country? Well, I'm going to answer that question, just for the sake of the record. In Protestantism today, there is a kind of sanctified Thomism. Methodism is a collection of negations of basic Calvinistic doctrines, plus an apologetic, frankly and openly taken from St. Thomas Aquinas. And with its serious negations on the biblical doctrine of sin and of man since the fall, it has adopted essentially a program of good works. Now, to be sure, and I'm using the Methodist as an illustration, the Methodist doctrine of good works could not be that of the Roman Catholic Church. After all, the Reformation anchorage of the Methodism was too strong to allow it to come to the good works of the Council of Trent. And so, these Arminian evangelicals have adopted their own program of good works. And it speedily descended into the realm known as the social gospel. The social gospel is the Arminian answer to the Roman Catholic doctrine of good works. Now, in this country, this is what's happened. You take the Arminian groups, for Arminianism, frankly, in this country, is the Protestant version of Thomism. Now, I admit there are differences. I admit they don't have seven sacraments. I'm frankly glad to admit that. I'm glad to admit they don't have the sacerdotal clergy. I'm glad to admit other omissions. But it is apologetic. And its basic concept of grace, Protestant Arminianism, is essentially that of St. Thomas. And frankly, between the two of them, I prefer St. Thomas. Now, let me make another observation. As you look upon the modern theological scene in this country, you see hierarchies developing in the Presbyterian Church UPUSA. You see it developing in the Presbyterian Church US. You see it developing in the Episcopal Church. You see it well entrenched in the Methodist Church. You see it developing in Lutheran circles. And you wonder why. May I make one further observation? When a church loses its basic theology and is somewhat or even acutely aware of its loss, it almost immediately erects a hierarchy to safeguard its position. The Council of Trent, although it refused to create an absolute monarchy in the Roman Church, made such a monarchy inevitable. The real genesis of papal spiritual power came with the Renaissance papacy. As the church underwent the turmoil of post-Thomism and the various schools of thought among the post-Thomists, the papacy gathered steam as the agency which would prevent the further breakdown of the Thomistic synthesis. The Council of Trent solidified Thomistic theology within the Roman Church, and in the Tridentine Decrees, in the Catechism of Pius IV, it laid down the fundamental doctrines of the Church and said these were to be taught. But lurking under this was the inevitable tendency of a synthesis to fall apart. And to prevent the falling apart of that synthesis, at first, in actuality, if not in law, the Roman Catholic papacy became an absolute monarchy. And in 1870, with the turmoil of socialism and communism breaking in upon the Roman Church in great inroads, the final step was taken with the doctrine of papal infallibility. This is it. And the Roman Catholic Church in the papacy announced the fact that the papacy must be supreme, it must be an absolute monarchy, in order to prevent the Thomistic synthesis from yielding to its enemies. Now, in this country, the Protestant churches have done exactly the same thing, and for the same reason. Even the Southern Baptists, a church without a creed, allegedly, and a church without a hierarchy, allegedly, are busily at work erecting a hierarchy. A creedless church must be a hierarchical church. If it wants to remain as an entity, it has no escape. It must accept the consequences of its lack of creedal structure. A church which deserts its creed will likewise produce a hierarchy. Otherwise, the church, the evangelical church of this country, would be a form of the Kiwanis Club or of the Rotary Club or some other social organization. And I might add just in passing, and I mean no affront to the service clubs, it's a lot harder to get in Rotary than it is in the Christian church. It's a lot harder to get in Kiwanis than it is in the Christian church. And this is true. And you start to think about that. The Rotarians in my audience are aware of that fact. The Kiwanians are aware of that fact. Much more careful than the Christian church. Now, with those observations, let us proceed with the decline of theology. But I've been laying the foundation for what I want to say. May I say one other point? For the more biblical, the more well-rounded, the more responsive to the whole counsel of God a theological system is, the greater the number of enemies which it will attract. This is parallel to what I said before. Because to the natural, to the unregenerate, to the unbelieving, to the humanistic mind, evangelical, Calvinistic, Reformed, biblical Christianity is very repugnant. Very repugnant. Because it draws a stark delineation between God and man at every point. It insists that the only way man may know God is by divine revelation. That the only way man may be saved is through the name of Jesus Christ upon whom they must believe, and so on. The servitude of the will. You know, in the Reformation, Erasmus stood in the sidelines and silently clapped for Martin Luther, so long as Erasmus said that he was hitting Pope Leo X in the breadbasket in his treasury. But when Martin Luther came out solidly, squarely, and profoundly for the doctrine of the servitude of the will and of election, he and Erasmus had a very sharp break, and Erasmus wrote Luther off, because Erasmus was basically humanist, and he could not tolerate, he could not stand Luther's tremendous affirmations in regard to the sovereignty of God. And this must always be the case. It has to be. And so today we come to the present state of American theology. But the question before this audience, the question which I must answer, the question which I must face is this. How did it come into being? How did we get where we are? How did we come to a place where ministers in the pulpit will openly not only tolerate a butt, pat on the back, homosexuality? How can they approve of pornography? How can they pat on the back the use of drugs and even indulge in them themselves? How can this be? How can the church walk hand in hand with marching communism as it has? These are questions which are should be disturbing to you and to me. Now, I speak as one inside the church, not as one of its critics from the outside. Yes, I'm a critic, but not a critic who has not had to agonize over his position, as I find myself today in June 1974. I pointed out to you, I think, in the first lecture of last week, and I know that some of you here today did not hear that lecture, that we start out with a pervading Calvinism, a pervading Puritanism. Many people have tended to restrict that to the New England Puritans. Now, undoubtedly, they were representatives of English Puritanism, of Calvinism. But when you examine the colonial theological record, the Dutch Reformed of New York and New Jersey and elsewhere were equally reformed. The Huguenots that came into some places in New York, into Virginia, and more especially into North Carolina and the South Carolina, were vigorously Calvinistic. They'd been through the fires. They'd been through the persecutions of Louis XIV. They had fled when he revoked the Edict of Nantes. They had striven to prevent the growth of tyranny under Louis XIV. They had done their best to maintain pure Calvinistic worship in France and Westphalia, Alsace and Lorraine, and those areas of West Germany, which Louis XIV annexed under his health and his wars. So that the pervading atmosphere in the colonies was one of Calvinism. As I said the other day, the various colonies were obliged to maintain Christian worship by their charters issued by the various English kings. So that we were born in a religious fervor. We were born on the momentum of a biblical Weltanschauung. We were born with the Bible as our frame of reference and as our guide. This theology provided what we call the New England and the Middle States and the Southern culture. To a far greater extent than many secular historians have been willing to admit, the colonies made tremendous progress. By 1700, by 1750, Boston rivaled London as a center of publishers. Schools were springing up all over. In North Carolina, particularly, the Presbyterian Church created academies, also in Western and other places in Virginia. Good centers of education, meeting a frontier condition with widely scattered peoples. They were erecting culture in all of its forms. But you see, colonial theology, the colonial church, was under attack. As deism made its way into England, so did deism make its way into the colonies. After 1700, John Locke was brought into the colonies. And having been brought into the colonies, he, as it were, did his deadly work. Now, I do not mean to infer that John Locke intended to destroy Christianity. He actually wrote a book in the defense of the faith, trying to defend Christianity upon his empirical epistemology, an utter impossibility which he did not see. Whether he was a deist, I think, is open to question. Some of my scholarly friends insist that he was, others insist that he was not. But whether he was or was not, he reflected the deist attitude, particularly in regard to his philosophy, particularly in his concept of the minds of Tabula Rasa, particularly in regard to his concept of the learning process by which we call epistemology. He certainly was one with the deist in his philosophy. Whether he was in his theology or not, I shall not debate this morning. But whether he was or not, his popularity, both among the Whigs of England, for his defense of the revolution of 1688-89, and his growing popularity in this country as a weapon in the hands of both ecclesiastical and political leaders popularized and opened the door for the destruction, or I should say, the onslaughts against historic Calvinism. This is very true. After 1750, and well, perhaps before then, but certainly after 1750, deism invaded the American colonies. Now, perhaps you say I should explain deism. Deism was a religious movement which had both French and English origins, which, using Locke as its philosophical guide, insisted that the only way that man can know God is through nature. Man's empirical observations of nature and nature's law lead him to God, a false assumption. The God to which that type of epistemological outlook would lead you would be a material God, which, of course, Marx accepted. It also, of course, led to the denial of the biblical doctrine of sin, logically even to the deity of Christ, logically to the doctrine of the second coming, logically even to a denial of the church and its divine establishment. Locke did not follow his logic for various reasons. However, by 1770, 1760, Franklin had openly repudiated the Christian faith. Jefferson openly repudiated the Christian faith. Ethan Allen had openly repudiated the Christian faith. And I could cite other leaders. Richard Henry Lee was perhaps equal to Jefferson in his advanced deism. The idea of the American Revolution was born of Christian concepts is totally repugnant to any understanding of the Christian faith. The Declaration of Independence was undoubtedly a pagan document, and deistic in nature and outlook. This cannot be successfully denied. And I think that those writers who would agree that the radicals among the colonies had come to see that if they're going to overthrow the sovereign king of Great Britain, notably George III, they must overthrow first a sovereign God in heaven. And I would agree with this. So that the American Revolution took on a religious as well as a political overtone. Now, this is not to say that all the Tories were evangelicals, or that all the Whig leaders in the colonies were deists. This is not true. Humanity does not divide itself up so neatly or so clearly. It is true, however, that when Jefferson came into the picture, the overriding philosophy of the American Revolution was pagan. I'm sure that the colonists who were evangelicals who joined the movement had a real reason. I know, because I've seen his writings, that John Jay very openly stated that he joined the revolution in order to control it. Or, in modern language, we'd say in order to frustrate it. And if that was his purpose, he was magnificently successful. John Adams had the same motivation. John Rutledge had the same motivation. As late as June 1776, he insisted that we could not possibly separate from Great Britain. The consequences would be too severe. And he was talking about deism, which he had just previously repudiated in no uncertain terms. These men were aware of it, as was Roger Sherman, perhaps, of Connecticut. I know he was aware of it. So that the revolution was potentially a radical movement. Note how I phrased that. Franklin P. Jameson wrote a very profound work known as The American Revolution, considered as a social movement, in which he delineates this undertone, this undercurrent, of which he and others would agree that the Articles of Confederation were a political representation, which was repudiated, of course, by the Founding Fathers. But from the point of view of theology, the interaction between the British royal officials, many of whom were the third sons of English lords, or even the fourth sons of English lords, and they had run out of royal positions in England to send them. And so they graduated from college, they couldn't go in the Navy because the second son had been made a general, or the first, I mean an admiral, the first son had been made a general, and so and so and so and so. And so the fourth son was sent to Virginia as a governor, or as a clerk of customs, or as the head of the smuggling service, and so on. And these men, with not too much to do, and plenty of time on their hands, engaged in a great deal of discussion, particularly at Williamsburg. So that deism made its great headways into the Anglican Church in Virginia, to somewhat lesser extent in North Carolina. And for reasons which I've never been able to entirely explain, it made precious little headway among the Anglicans of South Carolina. I am inclined to say, I'm inclined to believe, that it was due to a great extent to the tremendous influence of the French Huguenots in the Charleston and Low Country area of South Carolina, and to the Presbyterians, who had tremendous influence, which put the Anglican Church in a position where it had to, shall we say, be in a competitive position, where in eastern Virginia, it had things pretty much to itself, and in eastern North Carolina, except for McDonald, and down that section of state, it had things pretty much to itself. So that by 1800, when Timothy Dwight assumed the presidency of Yale College, the religious picture was quite bleak. Unitarianism held sway. Unitarianism was the shall we say, the formally organized ecclesiastical derivative of deism. There were various degrees of Unitarianism. Unitarianism, as it developed in New England through the deists, insisted that God had created the world. They did admit the world was here. And they insisted that man must live a good life. They had no real way of measuring it except the teachings of Jesus. And, of course, they denied the deity of Christ, becoming Unitarians. But they did insist that, for them, the early Unitarians, Jesus was a kind of intermediary. As I can understand the better thinking of New England Unitarians, they were very close to the Arianism of Arius at the time of the Council of Nicaea. They were not like the later Unitarians who denied any particular status to Christ. They did admit that he had a supreme gift of divine insight and acted as a model which we must follow. They furthermore believed that the good are rewarded with heaven and evil is punished. And this was pretty much their position. But all you know about good and evil, heaven and hell, is not through the scriptures, but through the senses. God is up there and has lost control of his world because the world is ruled by natural law, a natural law which can only be empirically observed. This is a combination of Newton and the other scientific discoveries of that day, Galileo, Kepler, and the early physicists, the early chemists, and so on. This was their position. Now, this is not to say that all churches yield to this. Far from it. It had its heaviest hand in New England. It was very heavy. Perhaps it, in any one single colony, it hit Virginia the hardest. It hit Pennsylvania. It had relatively little influence in Maryland. It had virtually no influence in Delaware. It did not have too much influence in New Jersey. It met vigorous resistance in New York. It did not take Connecticut too much. It was largely centered in Massachusetts and Virginia, some parts of North Carolina, and to a very little extent in South Carolina. This would be the geographical significance of this type of belief. But it is significant that the evangelicals suffered a serious loss as deism held sway. It was the product, of course, of continental and English Latin influences. By 1800, the time was ripe for a revival. And Timothy Dwight was appointed president of Yale College. When he came there, according to his testimony, and I have to accept it for lack of any knowledge to the contrary, four students were Christians. Of course, Yale was not the Yale today either. It was a small school. And so it's not as bad as it seems. But he instituted prayer meetings. And gradually, that prayer meeting grew. A young man came up from Edgefield, South Carolina, to study law, and he attached himself to that group. His name was John Caldwell Calhoun. A revival broke out, which spread throughout New England. But it soon turned to an Arminianism. I'm not accusing Timothy Dwight of sponsoring this, not at all. But The intellectual fervor now became entwined by 1820, 1825, with what I lectured upon the other day of transcendentalism, which not only had a pervasive influence in Unitarianism, making it more radical, but by its optimistic buoyancy, created a halo of optimism throughout the American nation, particularly strong in the middle colonies, the middle states, rather, and in New England. This brought forth in New England the New England theology, which transmitted itself to Presbyterianism because, not entirely because, but in one way, because of the Plan of Union of 1801. By 1800, after the Revolution, thousands of settlers were pouring forth from Pennsylvania and New York over into Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois. And by 1820, these states had been admitted into the Federal Union. They were pouring forth from North Carolina over into Tennessee, and from North Carolina into what is now Mississippi, and from Georgia into Alabama. And by 1820, Alabama, Mississippi, Tennessee, Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois had all been admitted into the Federal Union. And the opportunity for evangelism was tremendous. And so the Presbyterian Church, the undivided church, and the congregations entered into a plan of union to provide mutual missionary activity in the way of pastors and so on for the churches of the West. And this opened up Presbyterianism to the inroads and to the ravages of Unitarianism, but more particularly of the New England theology, which developed after Dwight through Nathaniel Taylor and others. And this was a modified Arminianism. This ultimately, of course, produced many, many strange results. Ultimately, it produced what we call the burned over district, which was Western New York. Incidentally, the burned over district of Western New York produced many strange theologies and even stranger movements. It produced the Seventh-day Adventists, originally known as the Millerites, which was a very strong premillennial group, which with great audacity set the date for Christ's second coming for August 1843 with a precision which history mocked. But nevertheless, they gathered themselves together, sold their goods, and waited for the day that didn't come. And I might add, and not many, too many people realize this, but the Seventh-day Adventists have a very, very fallacious view of Jesus Christ. It's not merely the worship of the seventh day. It's not merely things like this which set them apart. They are, at best, adoptionists, a revival of an 8th-century heresy in which it is held that Jesus Christ was adopted as the Son of God and is not truly the Son of God, but merely, I would say, to quote the words of Dr. Morton Smith in a previous lecture, he became a member of the economic trinity for purposes of our redemption. But he's not truly and everlastingly God. They also hold, of course, to the sleep of the soul at death. They also produced Mormonism. I mean, the burned over district produced Mormonism. It produced the revivalism of Charles G. Finney, which left disastrous results. Which is to say that Arminianism of the New England theology type gained a very great foothold in the churches. It gained a great foothold in large sections of the northern part of the Presbyterian Church in the United States of America, which in 1837 produced the split between the old and the new schools, a split which was healed on the surface by a major piece of surgical work in 1869, but was left the disease intact in the corpse. Now, this split in the old and new schools symbolized what was happening in American theological life. By its name, the old school, with its headquarters in the north at Princeton, its headquarters in the south at Union Seminary, at that time at Farmville, Virginia, these were the strongholds of evangelical orthodoxy, with great scholarship and great devotion to scriptures, great devotion to sound missionary activity at home and abroad. And in opposition, of course, was the New School, which held to an Arminian theology, denying total depravity in the sense that man can do nothing in regard to the achievement of his salvation, holding to a different view of grace, to a different view of the sovereignty of God. And I would add this, and this is extremely important. It was in this milieu of Arminianism, in combination with New England Transcendentalism and Unitarianism, that the first great reform movement in American life appeared. It came and was born in the midst of a theological decline. Thus, the abolitionist movement, the prohibition movement, what today we call the women's lib movement, and all these other movements, had their strength in and drew their leadership from this Arminian theology. I think this is very important to observe. And writers who are by no means friendly to the cause which you and I represent have openly admitted, in fact, they have insisted upon this. And evangelicals will admit this. I think for the most part, it drew its strength from what today many of us would call a radical, non-catastrophic type of post-millennialism, which had imbibed large doses of the optimism of the French Revolution and of the American Revolution, and had welded itself to the doctrine of inevitable progress, which was very much in the air. If you read the writers that day, Arthur Brisbane, who wrote a book in 1840 called Social Destiny, it's a very interesting book, for he outlines the American program of inevitable progress. He got it, of course, from Fourier and the French. He was tremendously influenced by Fourier and by the philosophy of the French Revolution. He was tremendously influenced by Jefferson. He was tremendously influenced by Transcendentalism and the English writers, and, of course, his predecessors, Ralph Waldo Emerson and others on the American scene. It's probably difficult for you, perhaps even impossible, for you to transport yourself back 134 years, and understand a writer like Arthur Brisbane. I use him simply as a symbol. Emerson wrote, "Let man stand erect. Let him go alone. Let him conquer the universe. For man is sovereign." This was the theme. This was the impetus for the reform movement. You see, even at that time, they were looking for a movement which would bring in a perpetual millennium. But man would do it. Oh, God could have a place. They would find a place for him. They would tuck him in somewhere along the line. But he was not indispensable. And if God didn't cooperate, that was his tough luck. Now, I say this. Arthur Cushman McGifford, Jr., writing in the Journal for Religious Education in 1919, said, and I quote, for he reflects this attitude, "Democracy demands a God who will cooperate with it, but not a God to whom it must submit. Democracy demands a God who will cooperate with it, but not a God to whom it must submit." Now, this phrase, as far as I know, is not seen in the literature of the period from 1820 to 1860. I think it was probably original with him. However, whether it was written or not, it was there. I made the point the other day that, as far as I know, in the leadership of the abolitionists and the peace movements, there were at best two evangelicals. And I don't think they took much part in the peace movement. They were more concerned with abolitionism. And that they were William G. Birney, who was the candidate of the Liberty Party in 1840 for the presidency, and Jonathan Blanchard, who for many years was the president of Wheaton College. He was a leading abolitionist. But apart from those two, the sound Orthodox evangelicals were not. Now let me go back to another facet of the American theological scene. I made a reference to Charles G. Finney, and I'm afraid maybe some of you may not like it. May I point out that for J.D. Douglas of Scotland, I wrote an extended article on Finney. And to get my information, I went back and read Finney and got all the contemporary accounts which I could. Now, I do not deny that Finney was a fervent evangelical. I would not deny that. But I would point out, and historical scholarship would demand an honest appraisal of his theology. Finney denied the lordship of Jesus Christ as a part of our conversion. He held to a second blessing. His evangelical appeal, I'm speaking of his sermons, was something far, far less than what would be acceptable in Reformed circles. But he left his trail of woe. He early became associated with a young struggling college in Ohio, to which he gave his blessing, if not his name. The school was Oberlin. This school was long the home of radicalism, long the home of defiance of law, long the home of theological heresy. Speedily it degenerated. It became a haven in those days for what you and I would call today the hippies of the abolitionist variety. In the 20th century, it spawned a great deal of communist thinking. It was and has remained a center of extreme radicalism. And it did not just begin with the advent of Darwinism. It began with Finney, very shortly. Because abolitionism and all the other reforms of that day depended upon and looked to a Thomistic view of man. And you might even say they went beyond St. Thomas, because I think sometimes we fail to appreciate that St. Thomas was much more closer to Augustine than he was to Aristotle. And he held a higher view of grace than sometimes we might be willing to admit. But with Finney and this movement, they took a very low view of sovereign grace and placed a great deal of responsibility on man, thus inevitably opening the door for the doctrine of good works. I see that I have not yet gotten down to 1860 or 1865. Gradually, this Arminianism became identified with proper evangelical and evangelistic approaches. Much, not all, but much of our so-called modern evangelism grew out of this Finney approach. Great mass movements of revival, and a tendency to preach and ease a conversion. Certainly something far, far, far different from which the Reverend Mr. Martin presented to us the last three evenings. Something far different from these lectures we have heard from the Lordship of Jesus Christ, where his Lordship was not really mentioned. Now we come to the period right at the war. In 1869, in the North, the old and new school Presbyterian churches were reunited in a great service, as I remember, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at two General Assemblies meeting at the same time, concurrently. Leopard Fletcher, a reputable, a good professor of church history, at Princeton Seminary, I think he has since moved, but I'm not sure, wrote a book which he called The Broadening Church, which is a good discussion of what happened in Presbyterianism in the 19th century. He openly admits, and he is a supporter of the reunion of 1869, he openly admits that the reunion took place by a group of concessions on the part of the old school, so that although old school theology remained in force at Princeton for many, many years after the reunion, the seeds of the final dissolution of the Princeton theology were sown at that time. And Arminianism, in the form of the New School theology, was retained intact. In other words, the theological issues which had brought about the separation of 1837 were not solved. They were swept under the carpet, or back under the bed, or back into the dark recesses of theological closets, in an effort to obtain unity in Presbyterianism in the North, which had, of course, a very interesting effect. It made the Presbyterian Church U.S., the Southern Presbyterian Church, the great stronghold of historic evangelical and evangelistic Calvinism in this country. It emerged from the war, tattered, broken in ecclesiastical structure. Ministers sometimes were paid $200 a year. The churches, in some cases, were destroyed. The flocks scattered. One of the things which we don't often realize was this, in some congregations, much of the manhood had been killed off. For instance, in South Carolina, 25% of the men in the Confederate Army were killed. The highest known rate in American military history. Many of these men were young deacons, were young elders, in some cases even ministers in the Presbyterian Church. The Evangelical Episcopal Church, for it was very orthodox at that time, particularly in the South, suffered highly. Many of its members were killed. So that evangelical Christianity suffered heavily in the South. But in Presbyterianism, the Southern Church emerged strong in its theology. Having inherited great leadership from before the war, it maintained that leadership. With Dabney at Union Seminary, Palmer, and Thornwell, having died during the war, was replaced by other men of great ability, if not equal to him. So that the ongoing of this theological leadership served the church, I think Dr. Smith said last night, for 50 or 75 years, and with that I would agree, for the most part. I think it did serve it for that length of time. The Methodist Church split over the abolitionist movement. The Baptist Convention split in 1845 at the same time, practically, as the Methodist Church. The Episcopal Church did not split. Southern bishops and Southern clergy prayed for Davis. The Northern counterparts prayed for Lincoln. And they got along in that rather tenuous situation with no national conventions to mar the harmony of the structure. After the war, the advent of Darwinism created a new theological crisis. Now, allow me to draw the picture for you. The abolitionists in this country were in a very peculiar situation in 1865. They were crusaders without a cause. The great cause for which they worked for 40 years had suddenly become a reality. They were had white horses, but nowhere to ride them. And after their failure to impeach Johnson, they were in a bad mood. Their radicalism was bubbling over. And this is historically true. You who dabble or you who know psychology may wish to explore it further. But the pre-war abolitionists in the post-war period became the ardent Darwinists. Let me give you an example. Lyman Abbott, a young man before the war, an ardent abolitionist, after the war followed social Darwinism and founded the Outlook magazine as an expression of a radical social gospel. Many, many men who before the war had been abolitionists became the early exponents of the social gospel after the war. And in an effort to find new support for the social gospel, they linked onto Darwin. Not always realizing, but when they linked onto Darwin in support of the social gospel, there was a logical conclusion to their activity. And his name was Karl Marx. After the war, then, Darwinism invaded the churches. The Northern Methodist Church capitulated within a very few years. Their seminaries were taken over for the most part. Now, there were exceptions. Soon to follow was the Northern Baptist Church. It capitulated. And out of this came the birth pangs of the social gospel. Coming in the early ecumenical movement, the pan-evangelical alliance, the Presbyterian alliance, were early expressions of the very close kinship between the social gospel and the ecumenical movement. For I am convinced that the ecumenical movement, no matter what pleas were made to justify, was basically a well-designed effort to throw the combined weight of the evangelical churches originally against the Roman church and in favor of a radical social and economic program. If you examine its leadership very carefully, you will see that this is the case. Now, the Northern Presbyterian Church began to yield to the demands of Darwinism. And prominent men like Henry Ward Beecher, for instance, in Congregationalism, openly espoused Darwinism. He was a great preacher, and I wouldn't deny his pulpit ability for a moment, but I would also insist that he was a Darwinist. No question about it. George Herron at Chicago was a Darwinist. Walter Rauschenbusch was a Darwinist. And so in Congregationalism, in New England, and in the Middle West, in the Northern Baptist circles, particularly at Rochester Seminary, where Walter Rauschenbusch held forth, and at Chicago Seminary, where George Herron held forth, Darwinism made serious inroads into the church. Now, some scholars, like Asa Gray, held to a form of Darwinism known as theistic evolution, in an effort to allow God to have just a little place in Darwin's vast scheme. They were not willing to banish him entirely to the hinterlands. He could have a place. He did cooperate, of course, with the evolutionary process. That was presupposed. Others, of course, had no place for him. Now, the atheistic Darwinists were the honest Darwinists. Make no mistake about that. And again, I would remind you of Charles Hodge's great book, What is Darwinism? And he saw this very clearly. He honored John Fiske for his attempts to do the impossible and granted his sincerity. But he also saw what was going to happen. Make no mistake about that. I think you can write modern historical theology in terms of these two movements. Darwinism on the one hand, and the ecumenical movement on the other. I know that some ecumenical leaders would hold and did hold, and some of them were absolutely sincere, that you must have the United Church if you're going to conquer the evils of the day, if you're going to make an impact for Christ. Now, this has a very appealing, but a very insidious concept behind it, that in union there is strength. In an amalgamation of theologies, there is strength. In an amalgamation of ecclesiastical organizations, there is strength. On the surface, that is a very specious appeal. Underneath, it is totally fallacious, because the Lord has never worked with majorities. And these men, so imbued with democratic philosophy as they were, they believed, although they wouldn't admit it, that der Macht ist die Recht, that might is right. Now, I see that come to the end of my time, and I shall conclude this tomorrow with an examination of the decline of theology, let us say from 1875 or 1890 on down to the present time. And then, in what time is left, I shall endeavor to point out some demands, some approaches to what I would call a sound reform within a biblical and a reformed context. And so once again, I say thank you.